Good morning.
It is amazing when we started this service, there were only like 20 people here. So it would seem if we do the 9 o'clock service format at 9 or 10, everyone still shows up late. As I've said a few times this month, this is LGBT Pride Month, and I've been doing a series on the Bible and the way that Christians frequently use it against folks who are LGBT. In a happy little coincidence, I have an announcement to make about the Presbyterian Church USA. Our GA, our General Assembly, sort of our largest governing board, is meeting this week. And I want to read just a little part of an article about something that passed just a couple of days ago in the GA for the Presbyterian Church USA. So on Wednesday, I'm just going to read this. On Wednesday, June 20th, the Presbyterian Church took a historic step by voting unanimously, which is a big deal, unanimously to accept 3 overtures submitted at their biennial conference in Missouri. The overtures both celebrate LGBTQ people of faith and speak out against religious freedom being used to discriminate against the LGBTQ community. More Like Presbyterians, which is an organization that we as a church are members of and contribute to, the leading LGBTQ movement within the church, supported the passages of the overtures. And I'm going to read each of the 3, just a synopsis of them to you. Overture 11-04, entitled On Reclaiming an Historic Reformed Understanding of Religious Liberty, says that it acknowledges the misuse of the term religious freedom in denying basic human rights, and reaffirms the faith and religious liberty cannot be used to discriminate against anyone simply because of who they are. Overture 11-12. Affirming and celebrating the full dignity and humanity of people of all gender identifications. It acknowledges the church's past mistake in being unwelcoming to transgender and non-binary individuals. Encourages the welcoming and acceptance of all gender identities and affirms their right to live free from discrimination in any arena. This overture also specifically mentions the rights of transgender students. And finally, Overture 11-13, on celebrating the gifts of people of diverse sexual orientations and gender identities in the life of the church. It apologizes again for the church's previous unwelcoming stance on LGBTQ parishioners, celebrates LGBTQ church pioneers, and states the church will welcome, lift, and fight for the human rights of all people created in the eyes of God. Now, if you know anything about the wording of Presbyterian overtures, that word will is really important. We have might, shall, can, could. When it says will, there is no option. It says will welcome, lift, and fight for the human rights of all people created in the eyes of God. That is something to celebrate. And so, continuing on that thought, part 3 of my clobbering biblical gay bashing series. Like I said, it is LGBT Pride Month, and I've been doing this 3-part series on what are known as the clobber verses in the Bible. It's a list of 6 or 7 from the entire Bible that are used to hurt LGBT folks. Hence, my clobber verses and the title of my message. Now, we still have 3 verses to go, and we'll be covering them today and wrapping this series up. And I'm going to have to warn you just a little bit, and I apologize somewhat for this, but today we are going to have to talk about some Greek words. But I do promise that I will try to make it as, well, painless as possible. Now, up until today, the verses have looked at they have only addressed male-male sexual intimacy. But our first verse today is Romans 1:26-28. So, good news, ladies. In Romans, you get to join in.
Lucky you.
Romans is the one place in the Bible, as I was saying, that specifically talks about female-female sex acts. Now, if you listen to anti-LGBT folk, you'd be surprised to learn that while the count varies on how many places the Bible directly addresses heterosexual relationships, it is a lot. So, compared to precisely the one verse in the Bible about female-female sexual intimacy, I guess even two about heterosexual would be like 100% more, right? Now, the number, as I said, about heterosexual orientation versions isn't exactly clear. One thing is really clear, though. There are plenty of them, and a lot like the Levitical purity code that we talked about last week, we've managed to ignore many of the hundreds about heterosexual. So, if you aren't also denouncing divorce, then you need to get off your lesbian judging high horse, because otherwise you're just picking and choosing who to judge by your own accord and then quoting the one Bible verse that seems to support your choice. And even then, as we're about to see, it doesn't actually support your argument. It actually, matter of fact, does the exact opposite. We'll talk about that in a minute. In Romans, we have the most extensive discussion about same-sex intercourse in the whole Bible. A whole seemingly two verses. It's astounding, right? Two verses. There are plenty of approaches, plenty, to understanding what Paul is trying to teach us in these verses. And good exegesis actually ultimately points us to the reality that what Paul is talking about and what people who use these verses as clobber verses want Paul to be talking about, well, they're not the same thing. That is, this is not about homosexual people having consenting relationships. Now, one convincing analysis of these texts looks at the fact that one of the most prevalent forms of same-sex sex in the Greco-Roman world was male prostitution, which frequently involved boys. Now, in that analysis, the text becomes a condemnation of pederasty, and prostitution. Things that most Christians, even today, from very conservative to very liberal, would probably disapprove of. There's also the perspective that Paul pointing to same-sex intercourse as being idolatrous could be referring to the practices of priests and priestesses of the Mediterranean fertility gods who regularly practiced that type of prostitution, but then they elevated it with a sort of religious context to the state of idolatry. Now, those approaches are valid and mostly convincing perspectives, but to be honest, they all require a small leap of logic to arrive at their conclusions. Much less of a leap of logic, mind you, than believing that these texts are about something of which the people at the time actually had no comprehension of. But slight conjecture at the same time. So, the analysis that I find the most convincing concerns itself with the word that's interpreted natural. It's a word that has led many people to speak of LGBTQ behavior as unnatural acts, even though they occur throughout nature. One study actually has found more than 1,500 species in which it occurs. As it turns out, the word is actually not natural. Now, hopefully this is not a surprise to anyone. But as it turns out, Paul did not speak English. Now, while the Bible tells tales of Paul performing a number of miraculous things, speaking English, which wasn't around yet, was not one of them. So, not to bore you too much, but the word that Paul used was the Greek word physikos. Now, that didn't hurt too much, did it? That was Greek. Didn't hurt too much. It's important. It's important to know the word in Greek because when it's translated into English, it loses a little bit of its original meaning. You know, without even knowing it, Lady Gaga actually provides a much better modern and contextual translation of physikos than the frequently used interpretation of normal. We'll get to that in just a second. You see, it doesn't mean natural or nature as much as it means produced by nature. Those who use these verses as clobber verses tend to understand natural to mean something closer to normal than they do to produced by nature. Now, not surprisingly, they also define what is and isn't normal based on their own personal biases rather than on science or the reality of the world around them. For example, I think that gay people make me feel creepy. So I henceforth do hereby dub it as an act of not natural. Now, in reality, physikos has more to do with how things naturally occur in creation. Now, at this point, you may have begun to guess that physikos is based on the same root word which we get the word physics from, which is, of course, the study of the realities of nature. Now, conveniently, the way Paul uses physikos here in Romans, it also means something very similar to the realities of nature. It's concerned with what is our nature, and not with what is defined as acceptable. That is to say, Paul is concerned with how God created something to be. He is concerned with people going against their nature, or in the words of Lady Gaga herself, if they are born that way, he is concerned with them behaving as if they are not. That is the sin here in Romans. As Paul would put it, the sin is acting against the very nature of who God created you to be. And in that sense, he seems to be addressing the idea of a same-sex act in which at least one of the two are actually not attracted to the same sex. They just aren't born that way. So, understood this way, it would be equally sinful for someone who is only attracted to someone of the same sex to have sex with someone of the opposite sex. And I just realize now that I am probably breaking the record for the number of times an ordained minister says sex in a sermon. So let me repeat that. Understood that way, it would be equally sinful for someone who is only attracted to someone of the same sex to have sex with someone of the opposite sex. It just goes against their nature. They just weren't born that way. So, ironically, telling LGBTQ folk that these verses means that they have to stop being LGBTQ folk are actually telling them to commit the very sin that these verses warn against. Going against their nature. God, it would seem, has a wicked sense of humor. Because these texts have been used so much to address homosexuality, it was important to address this issue directly. But the worst thing that we could do is to think it is primarily about homosexuality. It is not. You see, immediately following the end of this, verse 28, Paul then provides an extensive list of sins. It's so extensive that we all, every one of us, fall into one of the categories he lists. Basically, Paul says, so there you have it. We all sin. Don't try to deny it, and let's face it, we all go against who we know we were created to be. How many times have you done something, felt guilt or shame, and said that, I shouldn't have done that, that's not who I am? As Paul says in the very next chapter, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. As he also says to start that chapter, therefore, you have no excuse, whoever you are, when you judge others. For in passing judgment on another, you condemn yourself, because you, the judge, are doing the very same things. Let's move on to our final two verses. I'm going to lump them together here because they use the same Greek word, so prepare yourselves. 1 Corinthians 6, 9 through 10, and 1 Timothy 1, 9 and 10. So, we all remember back a few minutes ago when I used that Greek word? It didn't hurt too much, right? Remember how it didn't hurt? Well, we're going to do that again. I put, like I said, 1 Corinthians and 1 Timothy clobber verses together because they use a particular Greek word in a particularly similar way. The Greek word is arsenokiosis. Arsenokiosis. And it means male prostitute. Behold the Greek scholarship. See that it is good. Rejoice. Actually, it also could mean the customer of a male prostitute, or, well, could mean boy molester, or someone who abuses themselves with the man. You know, it could mean using sexual manipulation to attain money, to hold the great and powerful Greek interpretation. The truth is, in these two verses, the word interpreted as homosexual, which is absurd because in Greek there is clearly a word which only refers to men, or to sodomite, which is absurd, among other reasons, because that wasn't, as we talked about last Sunday, the sin of sodomy. Well, the word's just truly, it's really difficult to translate. Why? Well, this is not a joke. In part, because this particular word is only found in these two verses in all of ancient texts. Because it's entirely possible that the word's just made up. It's very likely that the Greek-speaking Jews created this word to port a Hebrew word from Greek, and over time, the meaning has been lost. So, it's just impossible to translate. So difficult, in fact, that scholars can't even agree on a single best translation of it. What most biblical Greek scholars can agree on is that it is not meant to be a blanket statement about male-male sexual intimacy. So moving on. There is this other word that shows up in the 1 Corinthians version, the 6-9 verse. It's called malakois. Malakois. Now, the good news about this word is that it's found in lots of literature. So there are plenty of references about its typical intended meaning. It literally means soft. Some say it means soft as in effeminate, but not in terms of sexual orientation. Others say that it's connected with being wasteful of sexual and financial resources. You know, there's others that convincingly point out to this particular type of male prostitution involving young boys. And, you know, also in the list of contenders is sexual perverts, sodomites, weaklings, the self-indulgent. Behold the great and powerful Greek interpretation. Lights and thunder, and there you go. It's powerful. Like with our earlier word, there really is no expert consensus on this. Malakois was a word that could be used to refer to things as diverse as men who were weak in battle or who were soft, to men who lived extravagant and pampered lives, or who were, well, soft. It was not specifically about sexual relationships. If Paul was actually trying to describe something about a submissive male in a male-male relationship, which is still not the same thing as homosexuality as we understand it today, it's very likely that he would have used the Greek word kineidos, which was frequently used to describe that very relationship. But he didn't. So stop acting
like he was.
You know, in summary of my look at the Christian church's use of clobber verses, if you want to call homosexuality a sin, well, you know what, go ahead. But if you are going to have to admit that it is not biblically a sin. Which means you are calling it a sin simply because that's what you want to do. And because of that, you are going to have to admit that biblically you are a sinner for using God's name for false pretenses. It's a little thing we like to call using God's name in vain. And then Paul has something to tell you in Romans 2:1. You have no excuse, whoever you are, when you judge others. For in passing judgment on others, you condemn yourself, because you, the judge, are doing the very same thing. Are there those who have thoughts that they want to share with your community? David?
Thank you, Mark, for your exploration of these issues that need to be forcefully debunked. I wanted to say that since I left my electronic King James Version at home, and I haven't done any gay bashing lately, that one thing that might help me is for you to give the typical translation of those passages and then explain why they're not, because I haven't read them.
Sure, lately. Absolutely. I think that would be.
That way you would say, well, typically it's translated this way.
Right.
And that doesn't hold.
Having that as a printed version would be a lot better than just hearing it orally.
Yeah. Anyway.
Agreed, yeah. Maybe I can work on putting that together for you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Others.
Good morning. Thank you for the message. My name is Gracia. A couple of questions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I think about the scripture that you read, I would have never understood it that way until you brought the Greek translation,
right,
which is really good. But then once you brought it, then a lot of other things sort of, like a domino, fell into place. Like, if you think about sin being the thing that someone is doing that's against their nature,
right?
So then that is a burden.
Uh-huh.
And then sin, therefore, is something that's a burden. And then there's Matthew that says, my yoke is easy.
It's light.
My burden is light.
Yeah.
So it's like now all of those things sort of
makes sense,
right? Which is
neat,
really interesting.
Yeah.
It's just so connecting. And then the other thing, which I've been wanting to ask someone, is the King James, who we think about when we think of the King James Bible, that particular King James, did he have male lovers?
It is understood that he probably did, yes.
Okay, so that's enough.
Are there others who have comments that they'd like to share? I saw two hands halfway go up.
So I'm happy that I raised my daughter, or our daughter, come from that married an Episcopalian church because I chose to. We have someone in the family that is gay.
Yeah. And
but
that's really, the question of love is the thing this really comes down to.
Yeah. I lost a good friend, hairdresser.
That unfortunately is why a lot of what the church does pushes people to a place where they feel like they're judged or condemned by God in some way, and it can make life really overbearing and difficult to go through this. Are there others?
Well, it stirred my thoughts about a lot of things. I'll try to keep focused. the sin, of course, your origin of the word sin is sense. And so sin and sense are from the same origin, meaning of the body. Desires of the body are condemned as natural desires of the body are condemned often as sinful. like sometimes some churches will condemn the urge to dance, which is very strong as sin. Sexual urges, all of those things. And there's been so much of that in these dominant authoritarian patriarchal religions, condemnation of the body of our planet because it is so physical. I think in a way it boils down to that. Not loving the body, not seeing the body as spiritual, dividing spirit from body, which is not necessary. And the old pagan religions that did not do that, then condemned out of hand as being evil. And so that's what it stirred me to think of.
Great. Thank you for sharing that. One more down front, and then you're okay? We do have time for one more. Jim Knorr.
All the labels of today, which are the labels of culture, to me seem they need to disappear. And the label that needs to come forth stronger is divine. We are all divine creatures. That was the message of the man, Jesus.
Absolutely.
He was divine, and he told us, he told all of the people then, and his message is still very prominent today, is that we are all divine.
Absolutely.
And if we see each other divine, all of the other labels of culture will die.
Absolutely. Lovely sentiment to end on. Thanks for sharing that. Turn it back over to you, Ralph.